This programming is sponsored by Linscombe Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at linscombewealth.com.
Hey, welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rodinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us as we get to do our favorite thing every week, and that's talk politics. Brandon, my man, we've got a lot to talk about as always. Lots going on in Texas, lots going on nationally, and of course, the big news is we have ourselves a Supreme Court Justice. 9. 8 is not enough, Brandon. We got number 9.
That's right.
Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed by the hair of his chinny chin chin.
Right. I think 8 would have been enough for the Democrats, but yeah, now there are 9.
Yeah, so what do we know here? What's your thoughts on this? What's the impact of the Kavanaugh confirmation? What does it mean from a politics perspective here?
Yeah, I think that, you know, both sides are energized by this. The question is, who's energized more? My sense was that the Democrats were pretty much already at 11 in terms of outrage, so I don't know how much higher they have to go. But the Brett bounce for Republicans, I think, is going to be pretty significant. So that's what I think shows the difference. And you've got polling here in Texas, which over the last couple of days has shown increasing distance between Cruz and O'Rourke. I think part of it is this, because there's something special that Republicans just love about a conservative court. So it's moving in their direction, I think. And as Mitch McConnell says, it's not the end of it, right? There are still more conservatives to put on the lower court, and who knows, maybe more Supreme Court justices to come. This is something that is not going to go away.
I have a slightly different take on this, because I think that what we're seeing is this odd compression in the news cycle and the odd sort of outrage compression, right? Yeah. It wasn't that long ago where we were up in arms about anonymous op-eds, or we were up in arms about Bob Woodward's fear, or scandals from the administration. I'm not even sure Brett Kavanaugh is going to register in about a week in the way our news cycle works. So I think the Brett bounce may not have this long-lasting impact that anybody thinks. But what I do think will happen is that it has polarized the electorate more so than it had before. You see a move among Republican women away from the Republican Party, at least suburban women, away from the Republican Party. And I think that might have a long-lasting effect. But I'm skeptical frankly on either side that you're going to see any long-lasting impact, because there's not been much impact on anything because the shelf life of any of these sort of news items seems to be, you know, measured in hours or if not minutes.
Yeah, but it's a brag point for them. And I think that the president has been trumpeting that, and that's something that a lot of Republicans down ballot can point to as being something which is independent from Trump, but also connected to Trump. And that's a fine line to walk.
Well, you know, what's not a brag point is when you keep losing key members of your administration.
Yikes.
And, you know, I think it would be fair to say that one of the most popular members of the Trump administration has been United Nations Ambassador Nikki Haley. She sort of abruptly resigned. There was a lot of speculation as to what it means both politically and kind of who's next up in that spot and what happens with her. But Nikki Haley's resigned, kind of effective before the midterms, Brandon, kind of unusual.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, she had pigeoned herself as somebody who was able to kind of communicate to her inflammatory and sometimes explosive boss, the president, on things like Russian sanctions, the value of the UN, just period. And so these are things I think that definitely will show that there's a gap that needs to be filled. Now, Dana Powell, who's a Goldman Sachs executive and former White House official, is talked about as a possible replacement. But there's some internal consternation about whether or not that's the right choice. Some in the administration, like the National Security Advisor John Bolton, want to go in a more hawkish direction. But ultimately, like you say, the revolving door in the White House is creating serious complications.
And this timing
is awful.
Brandon, we'd be remiss without suggesting that the president floated a name out himself. None other than his daughter, Ivanka.
Oh, no, I didn't hear that.
Yeah, apparently he thinks that no one would be more qualified and would make a finer ambassador of the UN than Ivanka Trump.
Wow.
But all jokes aside, I think the resignation of Nikki Haley is interesting. There's speculation about her potentially in this sort of grand switcheroo where Jeff Sessions is let go at the end of the midterms. Lindsey Graham, who's suddenly become President Trump's favorite United States senator becomes...
Certainly the loudest, right?
Yeah, certainly the loudest, becomes the Attorney General.
Wow.
And Nikki Haley becomes the next senator from South Carolina. Or there's always Nikki 2020.
It's like a soap opera, right? There are too many different subplots. It's hard to keep up, right? Well, one thing that came up this week was the president has penned an op-ed in USA Today, basically excoriating the Democratic Party. Jay, what are some of the highlights for you?
Oh, man. Where to start? It bordered, you know... USA Today, which is a widely circulated national newspaper, has been pretty roundly criticized for, number one, printing it. I think he set a record for the number of, I want to say, misstatements.
Really?
In this. It's interesting because it reads a lot like a policy paper that maybe Stephen Miller out of the White House would have put out.
More reactionary.
And it was clear that USA Today was trying to cover its bases. They had a series of hyperlinks associated with the story that seemed to call into question the veracity of the stories that at least a Trump op-ed. But a couple of quick highlights that caught my eye. One, the cost estimates for Medicare for All programs, comparing the Democratic Party economic policies to Venezuela and socialism,
right.
Talking about Democrats as supporting open borders.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of, I think, political red meat. It's unusual for a couple of reasons. One, this read like something that the president would give at a rally or a campaign stop.
Right.
It's not the kind of sort of large-scale general audience document that you want to put out there that tries to sort of take a more muted approach in terms of a message. So it just was really an odd forum for the kind of message he put out.
Yeah. He implied here... Well, I didn't even imply. He said directly that the truth is the centrist Democratic Party is dead. I don't know what to make of that, since centrists in both parties have been declining for at least 20 years. So maybe that's true, but it's true for both parties. My initial reaction was flame on. Like, this is just a complete explosion of talking points, kind of along the lines you said. I think whoever wrote this had their thesaurus open to the page that had the word radical on it. So, yeah, it's an oddly conventional choice for the president, right, to write something in USA Today. My take beyond just the kind of politics of it was that most of it was about healthcare, and this is really where a lot of these fights are being held. So in down-ballot races, you don't see as much talk directly about Trump and his sort of influence on the office. It's a lot about healthcare, and Trump, I think, did... what Republicans have been asking him to do, which was really to head-on tackle the Medicare for All issue. So to me, this is probably a signal that the party recognizes this is a problem and that the president knows that they've got to defend their turf.
Well, the polling data is pretty clear on this. Medicare for All conceptually is incredibly popular. We know that from state-by-state polls and national polls. Medicare is bipartisan popular. It's interesting that he characterized it that the Democrats' suggestion for Medicare for All was somehow killing Medicare, which he has vowed to protect. He brought up the issue of pre-existing conditions again that he says he wants to protect, while simultaneously wanting to essentially trying to end that program. So it's an interesting piece, but I think it speaks to the potency, the political potency of healthcare. Democrats, I think, would be wise to recognize that what the president is trying to do is essentially sort of inoculate themselves on the issue of healthcare. Democrats probably should be spending more time talking about healthcare and less time talking about Donald Trump.
Yeah, there was a reason that there was pushback on this. I mean, if this was just some average issue that the president put out, it would be ignored by Democrats. But Chuck Schumer, right, the sort of most high-ranking Democrat in the Senate, was very pointed in his criticism. So that, I think, is definitely a signal that this is where much of the meat of the election will be about. But, Jay, not just the president is involved in politics now. We have all kinds of people who have weighed in, including your favorite, Taylor Swift.
That's right. Tay-Tay has entered the discussion. She's telling people to shake it off and get out there and vote for the Democrats. She came out and endorsed Phil Bredesen, the former mayor of Nashville, who's running for governor.
Yeah.
In a hotly contested race against Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn. Kind of unusual. She had not been very political before, but now has been urging her followers to get out there and support Phil Bredesen. But what's interesting is vote.org, she had tweeted this out, put it out on Instagram, that's her endorsements, had seen a surge in voter registration. So Swift Nation is responding and... they are coming out in force. Yeah, 64,000, I think, was the increase they were estimating. They said that in Tennessee alone, you've seen an influx of participation in politics. So it'll be interesting to see if it actually does something.
Right. You know what? I'm not budging until I know who The Weeknd is supporting. Okay. That's my
He's Canadian.
Point. That's
Brandon,
my cut point.
The Weeknd is Canadian.
Regardless, I'm waiting. I'm waiting. Until
Justin
we hear
Trudeau.
From him.
That's who we support.
Right. Well, this is, I think, good, right? More people being involved is always good. There's no doubt. But the claim that she was the sort of cause of this increase in registration, I think, is probably spurious. But I'm glad she did this because my examples I use in class for omitted variable bias have been a little stale. So this is perfect to be able to demonstrate that. This is one factor of many. The most proximate probably was that the deadline was like the day she did it. So I don't expect that this was tremendously influential, but getting young people involved is important. Their numbers lag significantly behind where older voters vote, and so that has to be remedied, and this maybe is one step in that direction.
Brandon, let's talk a little Texas politics and what's happening here in the Lone Star State. Our Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee is embroiled in a bit of controversy, a lot of controversy. Apparently, her intern has been identified as the leaker in the doxing case related to private information of United States senators. What's happened and how serious is this?
This is pretty serious. This individual has been charged with making public doxing, as you say, restricted information, unauthorized access of a government computer, burglary, and other violations of federal law. Obviously, this is not something you'd like to see happen, and the context in which it happened is very lamentable, but it certainly shows that there is just open warfare now between the parties and no holds are barred. I'm reminded, actually, of something we saw this week where Eric Holder, the former attorney general, said the following: when the other side goes low, we kick them, playing on Michelle Obama's line, when they go low, we go high. I don't know how to remedy this except to say that in an election year, it's impossible to get people to see the kind of unity of the country. It's a lot of partisan bickering, and this is part of that.
Yeah, I mean, just look, personally, there's got to be some parameters here, and we're increasingly seeing this kind of pretty aggressive, in this case, illegal activity going on back and forth. We saw a kind of similar deal not too long ago where people were sending white powder to Ted Cruz's office, people slashing signs of both parties. There's a lot of anger in the political process, and this is an unfortunate thing. We should all sort of take a step back and hopefully kind of dial down some of the rhetoric here. Well, Brandon, Governor Abbott has come out with a position that is a little unusual for Republicans, but he is backing the decriminalization of marijuana. This is kind of a big turning point. Greg Abbott signing on with Mary Jane. What's going on?
Yeah, this is interesting. He announced a policy where suggesting he's open to dropping the maximum punishment for possession of less than 2 ounces of marijuana from 180 days in jail to a fine. This, in some ways, mirrors what is happening locally, not just here in Houston, but also across the country, where local governments, like in law enforcement and DAs, are not enforcing this anyway. Ted Cruz admitted in the first debate with O'Rourke that he was possibly thinking the same, that maybe some decriminalization here would be good. Republicans in the legislature have also made this case. Is the tide turning here on the possession of marijuana? If so, why? And what effects is it going to have?
Yeah, look, the Republican Party platform has actually changed on this as well. Yeah. They're now backing decriminalization. This is, I think, a victory for a multi-year effort by folks who recognize or want to advocate for the legalization of marijuana. Mm-hmm. Decriminalization is the first step. Obviously, the use of medical marijuana is the second, with commercial and complete legalization being the final step. I think we're still a few years away, a few sessions away. The old adage is that it takes 2 to 3 sessions to get anything passed in Texas. I think so.
Especially like this.
Yeah, right? Especially something like this. So I think what we're probably going to see is this sort of decriminalization this session. And maybe in subsequent sessions, you'll start to see moves towards legalization. But this is, I think, a pretty significant thing. Greg Abbott certainly has the ability, if he chooses to make this a major issue. But this, I think, politically speaks to something we've talked about before, is that Abbott is entering a time where he's looking to have a much broader coalition.
Yeah.
You certainly see him sort of tacking a button much more to the center than he needs to, and I think in a way to kind of try to bolster Republicans during the midterm cycle. It'll be interesting to see if this version of Governor Abbott is what we see during the session, when it's a lot more, there's a lot more of an opportunity that he can actually do some things.
Yeah, I agree. He's definitely moving towards the center. And I think part of the reason is that he's trying to position himself for national office. So he's got ambition, even though he says he doesn't, I think, in that direction. And Republicans nationwide are more likely to believe this than Texas. So this is something where he's planning, I think, a couple of years ahead.
I think that's a really smart point you're making, because there needs to be leadership in the post-Trump America, and at least in the Republican Party. And a lot of the current players, to some extent, I think, are going to be stained by Donald Trump. Greg Abbott's really not.
Yeah.
He's not. He's outside that mix.
Yeah.
So he may be seeing this as an opportunity to move forward.
Yeah. Well, one person who is not stained, at least probably, by Donald Trump is Sid Miller, the agriculture commissioner, who has backed the Sons of Confederate Veterans and their application for a new Confederate license plate. What is happening?
Well, he's not stained because Sid Miller was Donald Trump before Donald Trump was Donald Trump.
Right.
Yeah, you
Trump
know,
stole it from Miller, right?
As you like to say, Sid's got to be Sid.
Right.
So it seems like every week goes by, Sid Miller just does something that much more outrageous, when sort of the national conversation has been moving away from the, for lack of a better word, the deification of all things Confederate. Sid Miller's decided to bring it back.
Yeah, run directly into the
fan blade. Into it, celebrating it, you know, kind of really calling on all of those old buzzwords and getting everyone fired up about supporting the grand old Dixie. And the Confederacy, with this plate redesign, it's just classic Sid Miller, and everyone is sort of shaking their head with it.
Yeah. Well, so the U.S. Supreme Court, in an interesting case, has suggested that states do have the authority to reject license plates. This is a 5-4 decision that came down a couple of years ago on a similar issue here in Texas, saying basically that this process would not violate the First Amendment because these messages on state plates are basically government speech, not private speech. So there's definitely going to be some, you know, disagreement. I mean, if it were me, we'd ban all, you know, UT plates, because to me that's like angry speech, Jay. We need to have more.
I can't
more.
Even believe you're sitting there saying that right now.
Apologies to you and to all of our UT friends. But so Miller definitely politically, I think, is not worried at all about his election. We'll talk more about fundraising in a minute and his relatively lackluster fundraising. But I think you're right. Politically, he has no fear in this election, and I don't think we're going to see him moderate at all, say, the way that Abbott did.
Well, Brandon, are you Texas tough?
You know what? I like to think I am.
As do I. But apparently Richard Linkletter, the famed Texan director, doesn't think Ted Cruz is Texas tough.
No. Yeah, so there's a new ad that's been directed by Linkletter that features Sonny Carl Davis, who you may remember from Bernie, the movie, and he really stole the show. Essentially, the ad, and if you haven't seen it, pause the podcast, go take a look at it because it's really funny, has Sonny Carl Davis basically attacking Ted Cruz for not being Texas tough, principally because he embraced Donald Trump after Trump was just thoroughly rude and mean to him and his family.
Yeah, you know, this is an interesting thing, because I've actually heard this argument before, and I think I'd be interested to see, because a super PAC is back in this ad.
Yes.
If it actually gets on air, because the argument is that Cruz essentially allowed the president of the United States to mock and insult his wife and father, and then turned around and essentially is like embraced him.
Yeah.
And the whole question is that, you know, kind of what kind of person are you to allow that to happen? Sort of questioning, the lack of a better word, you know, Ted's manhood, right?
Right. Well, I think that it makes Cruz look foolish for sure. But I'm not sure politically it's that damaging, because Cruz has made a pretty good case and has really threaded the needle on the Trump issue. Not getting too close to Trump, but not getting too far away from him. And partly he makes the case that he couldn't have distanced himself from Trump because it would have hurt Texas and Texans. So I think that Cruz has got a pretty good out from this, but I do think that it's clearly one more issue that Cruz is going to have to overcome. There's so much of this kind of social media buzz against Cruz. Even Saturday Night Live last week had a sort of, you know, attack on him being basically a nerd, getting a nosebleed. And how can Texas tough get a nosebleed, you know, trying to dribble a basketball? So I don't know. I also think that the super PAC issue is problematic for O'Rourke. Now, he said in an interview that he is not down with super PACs. And I don't know that super PACs are really down with him. They haven't spent that much money on him compared to the money they've spent on pro-Cruz ads. But I do think that, you know, for a certain kind of segment of voter, this is something which pokes fun at Cruz and probably brings down his numbers a little bit.
Well, I think the fact that Beto O'Rourke's father-in-law runs a super PAC probably causes a little bit of problem on how much he can actually be against it. But we'll see if it actually gets a general audience. The web ad is gotten a little bit viral.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, these days, you know, I think there was a video of Beto O'Rourke air drumming through a Whataburger drive-thru that went viral. So I don't know what
the standard is very low.
The standard is very low. I think there was one where he was doing his laundry. So it's gotten a little bit crazy out there.
Right,
Beto-mania. People, I think, are getting a little unhinged. And conversely, Ted Cruz has become, as you said, it's been easy to kind of mock him a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think the kind of the worms turned. And if you look at some of the polling, it's sort of come back to earth a little bit on what we had thought. I still think the race is probably a little bit closer than some of that polling says. Yeah. But we'll unpack that when we talk a little fundraising.
And it's web only. I mean, you know, if you really were serious about it, you put it on broadcast TV, which frankly is expensive and it's hard to penetrate in a big state like Texas. So I like the idea, but I think frankly, like a lot of O'Rourke's campaign, it's too much driven on Twitter and social media and not enough on sort of where people are actually getting information.
Well, speaking of information, apparently Sir Paul McCartney, the famed ex-Beatle, was here at ACL, which I'm going to next week.
Whoa, really?
Well, this week, I should say. And one of his able assistants handed him a flag that he believed to be the flag of the great state of Texas, except one slight problem, Brandon.
Yes, yes. Unfortunately, the red bar goes all the way across.
All the way across, that's right.
But not the Texas flag.
Right. He was holding the flag of Chile, the South American country. A little bit of egg on their face. Sir Paul, we forgive you, of course. You are a beloved figure by all. But someone needs to, you know, maybe he needed to have Willie out there with him to hand him the right
flag. Good. That's a great point. Actually, this has become a matter of the legislative intent, right? You've got, in the last legislative session, there was a resolution which was adopted by the House, Jay, from Tom Oliver's son here in Houston, who essentially introduced this resolution saying that it was impermissible or maybe in bad taste to text a picture of the Chilean flag in place of the Texas flag. No matter how much you want to, and no matter how much pride you have in Texas, this resolution essentially looked down on that practice. So I don't know, Paul McCartney could be in danger with the Texas legislature. We'll see. But it's like confusing the Union Jack with the Australian flag, right? Like, they're similar but distinctly different.
Well, yeah, I guess the only difference there is one is the result of the other. And in this case, the Texas flag and the Chilean flag are entirely different. But it is somewhat of a real issue because there's a lot of faux Texas paraphernalia with the Chilean flag on it, which has caused a little bit of, you know, concerns from an economic perspective. So, you know, you obviously don't want to do that. And it's embarrassing. But again, we forgive you, Sir Paul. Well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, let's dive in and talk about money, 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 Brandon. Fundraising reports 30 days out of the election. What do we know? Who's the big winner? Who's the big loser? And what is it going to mean?
So, Jay, we know that money is the mother's milk of politics, and in no case is that more true than in Texas in a midterm and a competitive one at that. So let's talk a little about what we saw with the last go-around here of quarterly fundraising reports.
Well, we've got a lot of things here. Statewide is pretty much what we would have expected. Governor Abbott is considerably ahead of his...
very wealthy.
Yes, very wealthy. He's got well over, I think, $26 million cash on hand, raising money kind of left hand over fist.
Yeah.
And Lupe Valdez would be doing great if she was raising money as a state rep candidate, but she's raising money as the governor of Texas office and is coming in, I think, with a paltry balance of $303,000 after raking in $680,000. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick is considerably ahead, raising about $1.6 million to his opponent, Mike Collier's $396,000. The one race of note that you and I talked about earlier, Sid Miller is doing his darndest to sort of test the hypothesis that it doesn't matter what you do statewide, as long as you have an R by your name, you are going to win. He is not raising much of anything.
Wow.
His opponent, Kim Olson, took in $131,000, which is not very much, except Sid himself only took in $25,000. Mm. That is unbelievably low for a statewide office holder, and it came from only 13 donations, Brandon. He is literally not even trying to raise money,
yeah.
And he's still probably going to beat her by a few points.
Yeah, no, she outraised him better than 5-1. That might be a record. I mean, the numbers are low, but that might be a record for a challenger in Texas in, like, the immediate term. So that's pretty impressive. She's running a good campaign, but I think, like you say, it's difficult to be able to undo and unseat an incumbent Republican, and this isn't enough money, really, to make that happen anyway. Now, you talked about the AG race, and this is, I think, an interesting one. Now, Justin Nelson raised a bunch of money to Ken Paxton's relatively good, but less than his opponent some. We also know that this includes a pretty big ad buy from Ken Paxton, so he is not taking for granted the way that Miller is that he's going to get reelected. And we spent a lot of time talking about this last week on the pod, so we know that this is going to be a competitive race. And it seems now that, like, General Paxton also knows that.
Well, shifting gears a bit, if we look at some of the local races for the Texas Senate, the three big sort of contested races are kind of two in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and the one down here in the Houston area. Senator Connie Burton in Colleyville is doing much better than her Democrat opponent, Beverly Powell, a little over $1 million to a little under $500,000. Here's the kicker, though, Brandon. She's raising a bunch of money, but the vast, vast majority are coming from essentially three sources, three big PACs: Texans for Lawsuit Reform and the political arm, which is the political arm of the Big Tort Reform Group, Empower Texans PAC, which is the hard conservative group, and then Texans for Fiscal Responsibility, which is essentially a new PAC that is affiliated with Empower Texans. Empower Texans is all over the place. They're the primary giver to a lot of these state rep and state Senate races, essentially trying to support beleaguered Republican incumbents hold off Democratic challengers.
Not just support, but really prop up, because in every case that we see a really vulnerable Republican, you see a splash of money from the Empower Texans and from the Texans for Fiscal Responsibility. Now, we should note that this money is not just coming from a PAC with a bunch of people. Most of that money, almost all that money, is coming from Midland Oil tycoon Tim Dunn, as well as the Ferris brothers, who are billionaires because of the fracking boom. So almost all that money is coming from, like, literally three people.
So, I know. And so three people are essentially trying to decide who gets elected to some of these Senate seats. They have these outsized influences in some of these races. The interesting thing to me is the lack of resources provided sort of from the normal process of asking people for money and raising money that way. This is really a fascinating thing, and there's no real consequences to it because no one seems to push back on that.
Yeah, you know, Republicans continue to outraise their Democratic challengers, at least in the last couple of weeks. But the caveat is, of course, like you say, that almost all this money is financed by just a couple of people. So if that continues, it's going to be really tough for Democrats to get out unless they can find their own source of this money. And unless that happens, until that happens, or until the people begin to sort of push back on this, I think you're going to see Republicans with a money advantage into the near future.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Gary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our coordinating producer and the keeper of our 401k, Ernie Manoos. Special kudos to our web and graphics team at Houston Public Media. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd, the Big Money Holster.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Roddinghouse. We'll see you next week.